Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. This week, a look back at one of hip-hop's most definitive acts, the Wu-Tang Clan. How does a group with 9 different rappers coalesce to create a tight, disciplined, and imaginative sound? An interview with the writer of a new biography about the most famous striptease artist since Salome, Gypsy Rose Lee. And an acclaimed BBC television series called Downton Abbey is now on PBS. Its creator on casting that most formidable of British actresses, Dame Maggie Smith. But first.
Bed, bed, I couldn't go to bed. My head's too light to try to set it down.
My, how show tunes can conjure up a place and a time. Listen to this tune and you think of an enraptured Audrey Hepburn swirling around in a white nightgown in the film My Fair Lady.
I could have danced all night. I could have danced all night.
Or Deborah Carr aboard a ship bound for Siam singing this jaunty tune to her young son.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid.
Or how about Natalie Wood bursting with the kind of joy that can only mean one thing, she's in love.
I feel stunning and entrancing, feel like running and dancing for joy, for a lord by your pretty
What you were actually hearing there was a voice that belongs to someone whose name is a bit less familiar. It's Marnie Nixon, a playback singer known as the Ghostess with the Mostess, because her voice was dubbed in for several top actresses in a string of blockbuster musicals. However, the classically trained soprano will get top billing this year when she steps on stage as the winner of the 2011 George Peabody Medal for Outstanding Contributions to American Music. Marnie Nixon joins us now, and some part of me wishes that you would sing your hello.
Hello, 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 hello.
How did you become a playback singer?
Well, actually, in Los Angeles, where I was born and raised, I was doing a lot of classical singing and opera work, and the dubbing that I was doing, to me, was just like a lark. It was an acting job. I had, as a child, I was a child actress at the Pasadena Playhouse and had done a lot of movie work, and I was working as a messenger girl at MGM. Just to make a living for my classical career. And word just got around town, and they kept calling me for various people, and so the dubbing career began.
There are new lovers now on the same silent hill, looking on the same blue sea.
How did this process work? Help me understand how Deborah Carr can sing all those numbers from The King and I, for instance, and do it convincingly when it's really your voice that we're hearing.
Well, it's actually pre-recorded, and we worked extensively together before we did the recordings. She would come on to the soundstage where I was learning the songs and she was learning the songs. They would have furniture set up according to what the set was to be. She would walk through the number singing the songs. I would walk with her as if I were actually a ghost image, watching her mouth and listening to her sing at the same time as I was singing. And then when we got it together, we would then go to the soundstage and record that piece. It was her job to mouth to that when they did the filming.
When you filmed The King and I, studio executives wanted to keep your ghosting role a secret. Why did they go to such lengths to keep you in the shadows?
Well, in those days, it wasn't known that that was a process that was going on at all. I don't think that they thought that it was a good market salesmanship. I think that the movies thought that people would boycott the movie if they knew that.
You've told in your own stories and in your own biography, you describe working with many of these top Hollywood actresses. It sounds like some of them had, shall I say, a fear of working with ghosts. How did you handle that? I mean, which actresses were accepting of this and which of them didn't much like the idea?
Well, of course, Deborah Carr accepted the whole thing and worked with me extensively. Natalie Wood, there was a lot of fear. It made her angry when they then threw out all of her soundtrack at the end and put mine in. Audrey Hepburn was very, very cool and wonderful, and she would allow me to be at her voice lesson there at the studio and listen to her so I could get really used to her speech pattern, which was very unique.
Wah and I, oh, be famous, oh, be proper and prim. Go to St. James, so often I will call it St. Jim.
You know, many of these films won a lot of awards, including Oscars. How did you usually spend those evenings?
I was very thrilled. I kind of had accepted that I wasn't going to get any major things at the Academy Awards. I guess I just swallowed it and just went along with the enjoyment of it, and I was happy to be doing a good job in a technical way. Because I was doing so much on stage, I guess my ego was not that upset, although I just thought it was a little unfair. And then over the years, it started getting to be known as it should have, and it didn't take away the luminosity of the picture. And I think it paved the way for other dubbers and for the reality of that process that was going on, I guess.
We've been speaking with Marnie Nixon. She's a soprano whose voice was dubbed in for the top stars in films like My Fair Lady, The King and I, and West Side Story, among other credits. She's the winner of this year's George Peabody Medal for Outstanding Contributions to Music in America. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much.
We're going to hear about one of the most successful collaborations in the history of hip-hop. The Wu-Tang Clan featured 9 different rappers when it debuted in 1993, and they are the focus today in our series on creative partnerships. Joel Rose has their story.
There's a moment on the Wu-Tang Clan's classic first album when the members are talking to an interviewer, and they compare themselves to the after-school cartoon Voltron, in which 5 robot lions combine to form 1 invincible warrior.
And the jizz of the genius is just the genius. He's the backbone of the whole joint.
He the head. Genius. Let's put it that way. We form like Voltron, and the jizz happened to be the head. You know what I'm saying? Yeah,
like yeah. Voltron, the voices of the Wu-Tang Clan seem to fit together seamlessly.
Smoking Joe Frazier, the Hellraiser, raising hell with the flavor. Terrorize the jam like troops in Pakistan, swinging through your town like your neighborhood Spider-Man.
There were so many different diverse voices sort of coming at you at once, very aggressively, but at the same time, it was one voice.
Sasha Jenkins is a writer and producer. In the early 1990s, he was the editor of a hip-hop fanzine called Ego Trip, when a friend played him a tape of the first Wu-Tang single.
It didn't feel like a lot of guys. That sort of sensibility and that energy just spoke to the chemistry that these guys had, and I believe the hunger that they had to sort of change their environment and change their situation.
The Wu was too slamming for these coke killer labels, so ain't had hit since I seen Aunt Mabel. Be doing all the sin like Cain did Abel. Now they money's getting stuck to the gum under the table. That's what you get when you misuse what I invent. Your empire falls and you lose every cent.
Most of the Wu-Tang Clan's members grew up in Staten Island. Taking inspiration from martial arts movies, they named themselves after a fictional sect of Chinese swordsmen, and they adopted an ethic of loyalty to one another that was born out of necessity and experience. Mitchell Diggs is the CEO of Wu-Tang Corporation. He's also the brother of Robert Diggs, better known as RZA, the clan's producer.
Me and RZA, we came from a large family, 11 siblings. We was very pretty much familiar and used to how to balance out that many people at one time.
Both Diggs and his brother had been signed as rappers to major labels before assembling the Wu-Tang Clan, and both had put out solo records that flopped. For the Wu-Tang to succeed, Diggs and RZA had to persuade the other rappers to put the group first, at least for a while. Mitchell Diggs says it wasn't easy.
The biggest thing was, how the hell do you feed 9 people off of 1 deal? You know, we laughed about it. But it was something that we thought about. You know, we knew that we had to create solo careers.
The Wu-Tang Clan signed with one record company, but their contract made sure each member had the freedom to make his own solo records. That was good for morale and for business. When the Wu-Tang Clan's first album sold 1 million copies, all of its MCs were able to cash in, including Lamont Hawkins, who performs as U-God. Hawkins says the Wu-Tang Clan did something together that none of its members could have done alone.
We come from nothing, and we made something out of nothing. We was trying to create our own industry, our own brand, our own situation, you know what I'm saying? So it's like an industry was being built inside of an industry.
The Wu-Tang Clan made millions of dollars selling clothing and video games, but success wasn't always sweet. Founding member Ol' Dirty Bastard died of a drug overdose. The other rappers built careers as solo artists or branched out into acting and film scoring. When the Wu-Tang Clan came back together to record, the arguments were inevitable. But Mitchell Diggs says the group found a way to resolve them.
When there's tension and dudes are beefing and there's whining, we have sit-downs. We go through 50 songs and say, what did you don't like? And then we tweak them. And if you still don't like it, then guess what? You're not on that song no more. Excuse my French for cursing, but get out the way. We like the way the song is and leave it alone.
Occasionally, the Wu-Tang's internal disagreements have gone public, as they did during the making of the Clan's 2007 album, Eight Diagrams.
Old man told me don't be blind to deception, only chop of affection, homie, your mind is a weapon.
Relax. You got your muscle tight. Relax.
Rapper Raekwon complained about RZA's atmospheric production style to an online journalist.
RZA's trying to create too much of a orchestra, piano. This is not the vibe I want.
Right.
But
this
it's his vibe.
You.
It's
it
his vibe. It's like he's like a hip-hop hippie right now.
Raekwon is using other producers on a solo album that's due out later this year. RZA is not appearing on the Wu-Tang Clan's current tour because he's in Asia directing a martial arts movie. But his brother, Mitchell Diggs, says the Wu-Tang members generally do get along. And to make their partnership work, he insists they all share a single dressing room on the road.
If you can't get in the room, you're going to come on that stage unfocused. You're not going to have the chemistry. Keep the friends and family out and give them the dress room so they can meditate, stare at each other. Even if they got to argue for 10 minutes, get it off their chest. And when you hit that stage, you're one body.
A partnership more like the Chinese swordsman who inspired them than most people expected. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose.
Are you with me where you at? In the front, in the back, killer bees on attack. My peoples, are you with me where you at? Smoking meth, hitting cats on the block with the gas.
Let me entertain you.
To say that Gypsy Rose Lee was a stripper is a bit like calling Frank Sinatra a saloon singer. Yes, but she was the most popular theatrical entertainer of her time, famed as much for her wit as her shtick. Yes, she slipped off certain articles of clothing, but you'd see just as much flesh in a Doris Day movie. And Gypsy Rose Lee flung gloves or ribbons into the audience, but always left her admirers wanting more.
That's all there is. There isn't any more.
Do it like it didn't star in Gotta.
Oh, boys, I couldn't. I catch cold.
Karen Abbott has written a book about this extraordinary entertainer. Her book is American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me, Scott.
Give us a sense of what it was like to watch Gypsy Rose Lee perform on stage.
Well, Gypsy was one of a kind. I mean, when you saw her, you had never seen anything like her before, and you never would again. One of my grandmother's cousins saw Gypsy perform, and he said that Gypsy took a full 15 minutes to peel off a single glove, and that she was so damn good at it that he gladly would have given her 15 more. Anyone who can make peeling a glove that enticing, I need to know more about this woman. And luckily, she just continued to fascinate me.
Well, part of it, I mentioned shtick, part of it was the patter that she kept up while she entertained.
Yeah, that's true. She became known as the intellectual stripper.
Have you the faintest idea about the private life of an exotic dancer? Well,
Up until a few years ago, it was New York's second largest industry. Now, a fan dancer's education requires years of concentration. And for the sake of explanation, take a look at me.
Her great accomplishment, I think, with her stripping was the idea of blending sex and comedy. And she was the only one to really latch on to that. And, of course, she started drawing big names. I mean, H.L. Mencken is the one who coined the word ecdysiast in her honor. She became, you know, good friends with many New York literati and became an author herself. So it was sort of the idea that here's a stripper who puts on more than she takes off and uses her wit to entice people. And the idea of turning performance into desire. She really understood that people wanted most what they'll never have.
Between her mother, Rose, and her sister, Baby June, who later became known, of course, by the name June Havoc, the actress, Gypsy Rose Lee, or Louise, as she was born, grew up in just about the most famously dysfunctional family of all time, the Hovick family of Seattle. Bring us inside that family, if you could.
Oh, you know, Scott, it was the most interesting and the most wrenching part of the research. I would spend hours in Lincoln Center looking through their archives and these letters back and forth to each other, and it was so volatile and erratic. And in one note, Rose would be telling Gypsy how much she loved her and please forgive her for the awful past. And the next note, she would be threatening to blackmail her for all the dark and secret things she'd done before she became famous. Growing up, I mean, it was those girls were abused in a way. They didn't have any schooling. They were not brought to doctors or dentists. Their mother pitted them against one another and taught them to trust no one but her, especially men. There was a whole theme of distrust of men running through that family. And of course, the mother, she was not well, as June Havoc says pretty frankly now. She was mentally ill, and today there would be help for her.
How did Louise Hovick, almost in the space of an afternoon, in the way you tell it, reinvent herself as Gypsy Rose Lee?
You know, I love that. Gypsy was nothing if not calculating. She was at a theater, and the main lead had either gotten sick or had been arrested. There's a little discrepancy about that story. Could I quote myself really quick here?
Yeah, of course you can.
She told the manager that she could fill in for his missing lead, strip scenes and all, and then she sat down before her dressing room mirror and met her creation for the very first time. And she started speaking to herself in the mirror, and she told herself she was pretty and she was going to be a star. And Gypsy the person had a really conflicted, tortured relationship with Gypsy Rose Lee the creation. She was forever caught between her humble roots and her ambition to be accepted by the cultural and literary elite. She loved Gypsy Rose Lee because it brought her all of these things that she wanted, fame and money and security, but she also lured the limitations of her creation. She sort of lived in an exquisite trap she herself had set.
Oh, Mama, look at me now. I'm a star. Look, look how I live. Look at my friends. Look where I'm going. I'm not staying in burlesque. I'm moving. Maybe up, maybe down. But wherever it is, I'm enjoying it.
By the way, we're speaking with Karen Abbott, her new book, American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee. Help us appreciate how big Gypsy Rose Lee was.
Gypsy, you know, at one time was called the most popular entertainer in the world. She was more popular than Eleanor Roosevelt. During the World's Fair, they took a poll, and she beat Eleanor Roosevelt in that poll. Life magazine called her. She was the only person in the world with a public body and a private mind, both equally exciting. And her greatest trick was sort of to belong to everyone without anyone truly knowing her. It was a masterful magician's trick she had. Of course, during World War II, she was a favorite of the soldiers. They actually named a fighter jet, a stripped-down fighter jet, the Gypsy Rose Lee. And 10 regiments selected her as their sweetheart. So her popularity just it was widespread, and she somehow touched everybody in a certain way.
The musical Gypsy, of course, was drawn from her own memoir. To what degree was that story that we see on stage these days and that we know from songs, to what degree was it Gypsy Rose Lee's invention, and to what degree was it invented by Art Lorenz, the playwright?
I don't think that the play adheres much to the real story. It adheres partly to the story Gypsy tells in her memoir. But the story she tells in her memoir is sort of a sunnier, more optimistic version that what really happened in real life. I mean, on the stage, her mother, Rose, is this sort of erratic but kindly and just ambitious but certainly not homicidal woman who just really wanted to have the best for her daughters and celebrate their talents.
I had a dream. I dreamed it for you, June. It wasn't for me, Herbie, and it
if it wasn't for me, just where would you be, Miss Gypsy Rose Lee?
In real life, you know, their mother was not somebody who had their best interests at heart all the time. And I think Gypsy's way of coping with the real reality of her mother and with the reality of her life was to make it a joke, as she did with mm-hmm. many things. And she just made her mother a punchline. And that was the way that she could get her mother across. Otherwise, she said, no one would believe her. She didn't think anyone would actually believe the real story. So she made her mother a joke. And Arthur Lawrence's part in it, I think he adhered pretty closely to the memoir.
But when Gypsy Rose Lee would sometimes refer to herself as a prude, was she just trying to be funny?
I think she was a bit of a prude. I mean, deep down. And I say that because she had a very complicated relationship with sex. She didn't consider herself to really be a sexual person, but yet here she is being held up as a sex object. She was a prude in the sense that she did not want to expose herself, and that's both literally and figuratively. When she was on stage during her performance, she would never turn around. She did not want to see anyone to see her from the backside. And she also had a very complicated costume arrangement, and she didn't want people to see her tricks and how she kept everything together and how she removed everything so smoothly. It was prudery, but it was also private. She was a very private person.
She wrote all the time, too, didn't she?
She did. She was a voracious reader and a voracious writer. She, in fact, joined the writers' colony in Brooklyn for a time, mm-hmm. and she worked there with George Davis and W.H. Auden and Carson McCullers, who she became very good friends with. And while Gypsy was there, she was working on her first novel called The G-String Murders, which drew, you know, of course, much from her burlesque background. Yeah. And it was a bestseller and, you know, wrote several essays for The New Yorker and sort of cemented her status as a member of the literati.
You know, Karen, I don't know what moves me to say this, but even separated as we are by decades, I found myself reading this book and falling hard for Gypsy Rose Lee.
That's interesting. I always wonder what people's reactions are going to be to her. You know, my feelings toward her changed as I wrote the book. I felt sorry for her. I admired her. I was terrified of her. I wanted to be her friend. I never wanted to see her, run into her anywhere. You know, it just sort of was all over the place. So it's interesting that you say that.
Well, you read the book and you realize she was, although a sex object, she was really nobody's sex object. She created herself.
Yeah, she was very much her own creation, and I hope that comes across, you know, especially in this age of manufactured celebrity. Here's somebody who's just a true original. Who else but Gypsy Rose Lee would get a telegram from Eleanor Roosevelt that said, "May your bare ass always be shining." So I thought, you know, that perfectly exemplified Gypsy as highbrow and lowbrow. I mean, here's Eleanor Roosevelt actually sending a telegram to someone that says that. I thought that was fantastic.
Well, Karen, very good to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Scott. I had a great time.
Karen Abbott, her new book, American Rose, A Nation Laid Bare, The Life and Times of Gypsy Rose Lee.
If you want to grind it, wait till you've refined it.
If you want to bump it with a trumpet.
So get yourself a gimmick and you too can be a star.
The Bible wasn't the only legacy King James left behind, at least in Britain. There was also the aristocratic legacy, a world of landowners and their servants, and a way of life that lasted right up until the First World War. Screenwriter Julian Fellowes portrayed that world in the acclaimed film Gosford Park. He's done it again, this time for television, in the British series Downton Abbey. It premieres on PBS tonight. It's the story of the aristocratic Crawley family, known as the Noble Granthams, and it takes place in the 2 years before the outbreak of World War I in 1914.
They're not colossally rich, like the Duke of Marlborough, the Duke of Roxburgh. That's not it. But they are senior earls. They are the Earl and Countess of Grantham, and they have three daughters. They live in this house, which we chose quite deliberately. It's actually, in real life, a house called Highclere Castle, which is lived in by the Earls of Carnarvon. But it's built as such a statement of aristocratic confidence. You know, when you look at that house, nobody was scratching their head and worrying about their social position. This was a class that knew what it was there for. And we deliberately wanted that because the house, quite strongly, I think, is a character in the drama, really. They all sort of serve the house in a way.
Early on, we learned that that the Crawleys are not fabulously well. Obviously, they're very wealthy, but there was a point before Robert Crawley, the Earl, before he became the Earl, he was in danger of losing Downton Abbey until he married his wife, Cora, who is an American heiress. Were those kinds of marriages common at that time?
Oh, enormously common, because in Europe, to get an heiress, you basically need everyone else in the family to die.
Mm.
And then there's only one girl left and she's a great heiress. Well, naturally enough, that doesn't happen all that often. But the Americans don't believe in primogeniture, and they never have. And so when a man was enormously rich, he would make his daughters rich as well as his sons.
He would divide it up.
He would divide it up. And so it meant that there were an enormous amount of American heiresses as opposed to the European ones. And often, because they were very new money, they couldn't really get into society in New York or Cincinnati or Cleveland or whatever, because the rules there would keep them out. And so the obvious thing to do was rather like in the novel by Edith Wharton, The Custom of the Country, where Miss Spragg comes over to England to get a title. And they would arrive, and their enormous fortunes would attract these elder sons of houses on the way down. And, you know, in the end, something like 350 American heiresses came over between about 1880 and 1920 and married into the upper classes. You can't really imagine that now, can you?
And that American heiress, Cora Crawley, is played brilliantly by the actress Elizabeth McGovern. And her mother-in-law, the matriarch of Downton Abbey, is the Dowager Countess. She is played by the amazing Maggie Smith. And I don't want to give away too much of the plot because it is such an amazing series, but I am going to play a scene here. And in this one, the Dowager Countess reacts to news that a foreign visitor has died at Downton.
I can't believe it. Last night, he looked so well. Of course, would happen to a foreigner. It's typical.
Don't be ridiculous.
I'm not being ridiculous. No Englishman would dream of dying in someone else's house.
I wonder whether you wrote this part with Maggie Smith in mind.
I can say without question I wrote it for Maggie. And actually, it's our third time at the rodeo, because she and I were in Gosford. I mean, I wrote Gosford, but she was in it. And then she was in a film I wrote and directed called From Time to Time. And there is just something about the way she plays these characters that suits the way I write them, really. Because I think both of us are capable of feeling, but we're both rather unsentimental. And she, as an actress, has a wonderful dry wit behind everything she does. She doesn't plead with the audience to like her. She gives you her performance, and if you like her, that's your business.
In the house, the head butler, Mr. Carson's, played by actor Jim Carter, he shows us fierce loyalty to the Crawleys, to the point where he scolds the staff for gossiping about them.
She's a match for the old lady. She wasn't going to give in.
What old lady are you referring to, Thomas? You cannot mean her ladyship, the Dowager Countess. Not if you wish to remain in this house.
No, Mr. Carson.
You know, there are two great crimes for a servant. One is theft and one is disloyalty and not being trustworthy, because these people are living in your house. And, of course, in a day when they were helping you to dress and even bathe and they were present at every dinner and luncheon and so on, the capacity for disloyalty was enormous. So I don't think that Carson's loyalty is something that puzzles them. But what puzzles them is his love. But of course, you know, he has no other family.
How much research goes into recreating this world?
When I was growing up, you know, I had great aunts and things. I mean, my eldest great aunt, who is sort of the original for Violet Grantham, Maggie Smith's character, you know, she was born in 1880. She was presented in 1898. She was married in about 1905. I knew her. She only died when I was 21. I was very lucky because I got interested while that generation was still alive. Even my parents, you know, my father had an aunt called Lady Sydenham, who was a very frightening character. My mother was absolutely terrified of her. And they used to stay, and she loathed women smoking. She thought it was the most ghastly thing. So she'd say to my mother, "I hope you don't smoke, dear." And my mother, of course, would say, "Oh, horrible habit, certainly not." And of course, she smoked like a chimney. So she used to wait until everyone had gone to bed, and then she'd sneak up to the room of the head housemaid, who also smoked illegally. And they would puff away together, leaning out of the window. And this particular housemaid was a big film buff, and all her walls were decorated with the covers of Photoplay, you know, and Screen and those magazines. And, you know, this is the lovely thing about being a writer, because I was able to put that character into Gosford as Elsie, the film-mad head housemaid. And so in a sense, you have this kind of squirrel's pouch of stuff you've heard during your life. And, you know, when you get given the right project, then you can bring it out.
There will be, you've announced that there will be a second season of Downton Abbey. What can we expect?
Oh, I don't think I can tell you that, Cuff. I mean, I think I can say without too much letting down or letting the game away that it will be in the First World War when it begins, because we finished as the war broke out. And, of course, we will see how Downton has to be useful to the war effort and play its part, and the different attitudes of the people in the house and, you know, who gets called up and who enlists and this and that and the other. So I think we've got quite a lot to sort of be going on with, as they say.
That's Julian Fellowes. He's the writer and creator of the British period drama Downton Abbey. It premieres on the PBS program Masterpiece Classic tonight. The series continues through January 30th. Julian, thank you so much.
Oh, no, thank you.
Guitarist John McLaughlin never saw saxophonist John Coltrane perform. The jazz icon died in 1967 before McLaughlin had the chance. But John Coltrane's historic album, A Love Supreme, has inspired every twist and turn of John McLaughlin's career since he first heard it. Now the master guitarist has composed an album inspired by his passion for A Love Supreme. It's called To the One. It's been nominated for a Grammy Award in the Best Contemporary Jazz Album category. John McLaughlin is in a studio at member station KUSP in Santa Cruz, California. Thanks for joining us and congratulations on your Grammy nomination.
Thank you, Leah. Thank you. Nice to be here.
It's wonderful to talk to you, and I really want to talk about the album that inspired To the One and your career, John Coltrane's A Love Supreme. I mean, this is such an iconic, important album to a lot of people who are fans of jazz, and a pivotal one in the development of the genre. When you first heard it, what did it mean to you?
Quite frankly, Leanne, I couldn't hear the music. I couldn't hear it. It was just over my head. It took me actually a year of listening to that record almost every day to finally hear what he was doing musically. But this was the first time, and for me this was really significant, that the spiritual dimension had been integrated into the world of jazz music. And this for me is a phenomenal contribution of what he made.
Your album is one that is not one for instant gratification, although it is beautiful to listen to the first time. But there are layers of meaning in this. There are six parts to the one, and it begins with the tune you call Discovery. Are there echoes of Coltrane in this? We open the door to this recording, and there's a little bit of Coltrane echo in there.
Undoubtedly. And I'm very happy about that. It actually was not at all my intention to make any kind of homage. I had the idea to make a record simply because the music came. I didn't sit down and say, okay, I'm going to write a record, I'm going to write music, and I can't do that.
But you were, I think, unconsciously, perhaps subconsciously, channeling that spirit of Coltrane, his own piece, Pursuant, is similar to Discovery, whether you knew you were doing it or not. And Discovery is always the first part of a journey, really.
Yeah, it is. I mean, discovery in life. We discover things as we're born, we're young, we wake up and suddenly... I mean, for me, I was in this magical world. And I was born in the country, so I was lucky in that sense. So I would say I was surrounded by nature, but for me, the whole world was magical when I was a kid. And, of course, we grow up and we become a little more cynical. And so, in a way, I think probably more... It would be more appropriate if it was rediscovery, but that's maybe a little too pretentious.
Growing up, where were you growing up? What music were you listening to?
I was born in a very small village in Yorkshire, Emily Bronte country, Leon. My mother was an amateur violinist, God bless her, and so there was really just classical music in the house. But perhaps this one small anecdote I could tell you that I think really marked me for life. Because I was about 5 years old, and my mom had put the Ninth Symphony of Beethoven on the record player. And at the very end of this Ninth Symphony, there's the vocal quartet that comes in that is just really sublime, especially when you think Beethoven was deaf when he wrote it. I mean, it's just really extraordinary. And so this, I was sitting in this chair, and suddenly this vocal quartet came on, and my hair stood on end, and the hair on my arms and my neck, and I was having this experience that I knew was directly connected to this music, but as a 5-year-old boy, what do you know? You don't really understand, but I knew it was from the music, and I think it's from this experience that determined that I would be a musician in life.
In various forms of spiritual theology, Zen included, life is described as a journey. It's not a destination. And there's a tune on your album, To the One, Fine Line, about spiritual awakening and the fact that it's not, you can be awakened, but will it be sustained? I mean, there's a biblical story about seeds falling on fertile ground or in the thorns or in the rocks. Is Fine Line what you're expressing there? You've had this spiritual awakening and you want to try to stay on the path, and it's a very thin, fine one.
Absolutely. Everybody's spiritual, without exception. But it's a kind of the path, and the path is very broad, and at the same time, we're very susceptible to falling off. Which, of course, over the years I've done, but it's really it's a question of awareness of your own nature.
We're talking to guitarist John McLaughlin. His new recording with the band The Fourth Dimension is called To the One. I'm interested in a quotation that you attribute to Miles Davis, and it actually works into a question about the musicians that you're playing with now. Now, Miles Davis said, play like you don't know how to play. And Gary Husband, who is the keyboard player and one of the drummers on this CD, Gary Husband said you gave him so many instructions about how to drum, he was completely confused, so he just played his heart out. And were you deliberately confusing him, or was it a way of trying to communicate what you wanted, or you really just wanted him to go at it for himself?
What I want people to do in the band is I want them to be who they really are, and I want them to play how they want to play. But I think we should perhaps give the listeners just a little bit background on that cryptic quote, because I'd been in New York a day, and I'd been invited by Miles to participate on the In a Silent Way recording, which was, I mean, I was just nervous is not the word. There I was in the studio, and there was a tune called In a Silent Way, which is a Joe Zawinul tune. And Joe, he didn't know there was a guitar player coming, so the only thing he could do was photocopy his piano part and give it to me. So I had a piano part in the studio. So we ran it down. Miles didn't like it. We ran it down another time. He didn't like it. This is when he stopped and he looked at me. He said, I want to hear it on the guitar. I said, so you want these piano chords and the melody? Yes. So I said, that's going to take me a minute just to put it together because it's not a guitar part. And he said, is that a fact? So already, I was sweat was running down my back. I said, I'm thinking, what am I going to do here? I've got this piano part. He wants me to do the whole thing. So after about 10 seconds, he looked at me and he said that famous quote, play it like you don't know how to play the guitar. Play it like you don't know how to play the guitar. So I threw out the chords. I threw out the rhythm. I threw it all out, and I just played the melody, and I just played it real simple. And I was just astonished because he had been able to pull out of me something that I didn't know I could do.
Where do you move next, musically?
I'm not really moving anywhere.
You're staying in one place with your eyes closed, right?
The thing is, every day is new to me, so I'm not like I was yesterday in some subtle and small way. And so I don't even stop to consider where I'm headed, because it's I'm actually indifferent to that now. I'm just happy to be here right now in this moment, because it's really the only one that I really have, isn't it?
John McLaughlin's new CD is called To the One, and it's been nominated for a Grammy Award, and he spoke to us from Santa Cruz, California. What a conversation. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you, Leon. What a pleasure.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.